Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, the Utahns in the running to replace Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. The new research showing a link between Wasatch Front air pollution and miscarriages. And the neighbors working to shut down a homeless hospice on Salt Lake City's east side. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Aaron Alberty, and welcome to you, Aaron.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks for being here. We've also got reporter Taylor Stevens in studio, and good morning, and welcome to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
And joining us on the phone from Washington is Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Berg. Good morning to you, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
Listeners, you can join us for this Friday morning conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Or posting them at sltrib.com on this week's Behind the Headlines page. And since we've got Thomas Burr in Washington for just a bit this morning, we will start with him. And Tommy, very soon there will be a vacancy at the head of the Interior Department. Secretary Ryan Zinke announced this past Saturday that he's stepping down. He's facing some ethics investigations. And among the people President Donald Trump is considering to replace Zinke are two notable Utahns. Who are they, Tommy?
Sure. So Zinke is going to step down. As you mentioned, there's a kind of a spate of scandals he's facing, some of which will not end when he leaves office. But there's kind of a short list being looked at right now, and on that list includes Congressman Rob Bishop of Utah, as well as Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes. And we all know Rob Bishop is very steeped in public land policy. He's chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee for another 13 days. And as soon as Democrats take control of the House, he then becomes the ranking member. He doesn't get to control the agenda. So this would be an interesting opportunity for him. Should he be offered and should he accept? On the other side, Sean Reyes isn't really known for his public lands policy, but he was a big supporter of President Trump and was really big involved in trying to diminish the size of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase National Monuments. It's a short list, but it's not that short. There's probably another dozen people that are being considered, but Bishop and Reyes are in the mix.
You mentioned Bishop and being the head of that the House Natural Resources Committee for just a little bit longer. He won't have that role in the switch in leadership in the House. I don't know if that plays into that or into this very much, but do we know if Bishop even wants to be Interior Secretary? Has he weighed in on that?
His office hasn't necessarily commented whether he'd want the job or if he's looking or if he's even talking to the White House about it. He could be. We don't know. Like I said, I think it would be a more powerful position for him than ranking member. But it also would put him in charge of public lands. And he's worked with the secretaries in administrations in the past. So it would be a different kind of role for him, but we're not sure whether he wants it.
Sean Reyes, on the other hand, did express some eagerness or interest in that possibility, did he not?
Yeah, he absolutely did. He's essentially honored to be considered. And we have to remember that he was also considered for the head of the Federal Trade Commission in the Trump administration previously. So he's on the White House radar. But again, he's not somebody that's known for necessarily public lands in some ways. So that may be a detriment. But Trump necessarily likes loyalists over policy expertise too.
Has Reyes, Interior manages a lot of federal public land in, here in the West. We've got Bureau of Land Management, national parks, national wildlife refuges, national monuments, as you said. And those, the national monuments have been contentious here in Utah. Has Reyes weighed in on, the declarations themselves? Is he an opponent of national monuments in Utah?
He's an opponent of the unilateral approach in the Antiquities Act, the fact that the president can just name a monument without going through Congress. And he was a big proponent of changing the boundaries of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase. So it's not like he hasn't talked about this stuff before. I'm not sure actually how he feels about selling out public lands and a few things like that, just because we haven't really heard from him on those issues. So it would be interesting to, if he were to be picked, to kind of zero in on what his positions are.
Well, isn't the state, Utah has for many years been trying to take control of federal public lands within its border, to wrest control of those lands from the U.S. government. Would that would that become more likely if either Bishop or Reyes took this seat? That was something that Ryan Zinke, we know, was not in favor of when he was picked for this position. He wasn't somebody who was a fan of seeing federal public lands transferred to the states.
Yeah, no, this is the most interesting part about that. There were a lot of environmental groups that very much cheered Zinke leaving office, and I can understand they were not happy with his tenure at Interior. But the one thing that Zinke was very strong in is that public lands belong to the public and they shouldn't be sold off. They shouldn't be given to states. He thinks they should be managed differently, and that's his position. I don't know if Bishop feels the same way. I don't actually know how Reyes feels about it, but Bishop's obviously somebody who wants local control and for local communities to have say about what's in their backyard. So that would be a major change, whether it's Bishop, Reyes, or one of the other people like Senator Dean Heller of Nevada, who is also in the mix. They may not have the same position as Ryan Zinke.
Can you tell us why Ryan Zinke is stepping down, Tommy? I mean, if we go back a year and a half, he was charged with conducting a review of national monuments, or he was given that responsibility, a process that led to their downsizing, or at least attempted downsizing here in Utah by President Trump. That's actually in the courts. But why is Zinke going, Tommy?
There's a lot of reasons. One is to probably end some of these investigations from the Inspector General and elsewhere. He's been under fire for a lot of things, from the fact that he orders Interior employees to fly an Interior flag when he's in the building, to buying challenge coins that he can give out. But those are little small ones compared to probably the biggest investigation is into a land deal in his hometown of Whitefish, Montana. That involves Halliburton, and there's questions of, did he use his position to, benefit himself in some ways. That's actually being, that was referred to the Justice Department for investigation. We're not sure where that stands. And that one will continue no matter what. But there's been a lot of pressure for him to step down. Also, this administration, as we just seen yesterday with the Defense Secretary, people don't last too long. I mean, we used to count them in, Scaramucci's of how long people last, and in this administration, 2 years is quite a long time for Zinke.
Tommy, you also wrote about statements from conservationists on the potential appointment of either Sean Reyes or Representative Bishop. The Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance does not think much of these suggestions.
Not at all. Of course, I think Seward would not really like anyone that this administration puts into office in some ways, because we kind of know what positions they're going to have going into that job. Especially Rob Bishop, Sue has long battled with Bishop over public lands policy, especially national monuments and bills protecting the Center Fell Swell and things like that. So they've already they're already enemies, and they're certainly not going to endorse him for the job.
I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Reporter Aaron Alberti, you have written a little bit about, you've written actually pretty extensively about recreation on public lands in Utah and across the West, and you've covered some of these lands stories from around the state. Do you have a sense of the sort of legacy of Ryan Zinke from that recreation perspective, if that's something that you can identify? I mean, he's leaving now.
Well, I mean, in the after his coming departure was announced, obviously most of the conservation and recreation groups did not have glowing reviews of his legacy. Hunting groups and basically everyone else. I mean, everything from sage grouse to the monuments. Everybody kind of focuses on the monuments here, but there are other issues. And then, of course, Jackie Biskupski, mayor of Salt Lake City, kind of blamed him for the outdoor retailer convention leaving, though there were a lot of players in that. Not a lot of glowing reviews from the recreation community.
Sure. Tommy, something that Aaron brought up that I think is interesting is that, we have the outdoor retailers leaving Utah, where they've left Utah. But Zinke also talked about moving the headquarters of the Bureau of Land Management to the western United States. And a question that I have is whether or not that is still something that will be pursued after he leaves in January.
Yes, I think so. So Zinke's already started the process of kind of reviewing, what it would cost, what would the benefits be, what would the detriments be. And David Bernhardt, who's going to be acting, secretary until they get a full-time replacement, or maybe he'll be the full-time replacement, has very much been the guy driving that. So, Zinke directs it, but then David Bernhardt, his deputy, is essentially, the one doing the actual work. And that's been a big thing for him, is changing the kind of whole management situation for the Interior Department. So BLM headquarters, there's talk it could go to Denver, Salt Lake City, Ogden, somewhere in the West where the land is actually managed. I do want to remind, every time I write about this, I have to kind of remind our readers that most, BLM employees work in the West. There's, maybe 5,000 or something work here in Washington. So it's not like this is the headquarters is that large necessarily, because they're already out west, but the senior leadership is here in D.C.
Right, senior leadership there, but of course most of the lands that are managed are out here, and it's an interesting story, and you can check it out at sltrip.com. Just, Tommy, before we head to a break and lose you as a guest on the show, you also broke some news, some not necessarily unexpected news, yesterday, that the cube-like federal courthouse in downtown Salt Lake City will most likely finally have a name other than Borg Cube, I guess. Can you tell us why that's likely to happen?
Yeah, so this is an effort that started yesterday, but it's probably not going to happen until the new Congress starts in January. So Senator Orrin Hatch is actually presiding over the Senate. An Alaska senator comes up and he raises a bill that he just introduced that would name it the Orrin G. Hatch Federal Courthouse. And that passed without any objection in the Senate. The problem comes down to the House has a rule they can't name any building after a sitting member of Congress. Hmm. So essentially, they have to wait till Orrin Hatch is no longer in Congress to actually name the courthouse after him. But like you said, this was no surprise. I think we've all been assuming the courthouse has gone without a name for a long time, and Hatch is, former chairman of Judiciary. He's had a big impact on, the judicial system, including, who's on the actual Supreme Court right now. So it does make sense. I think there's some George Sutherland fans out there disappointed. He's the only Utah ever to serve on the Supreme Court, and they were hoping to name it after him. But I think Orrin Hatch has a little more sway than somebody who's not with us anymore.
Well, in commemorating the longest-serving Republican senator in American history, it's tough, though, because I've gotten kind of fond of calling it the Borg Cube, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to change.
I don't have to look at it, so you can call it what you want.
Okay, thanks very much, Thomas. We need to take a quick break, and Thomas Burr, I know that we need to let you go, but thank you for bringing us up to speed on these stories and for joining us for this part of the show this morning.
Thank you.
When we come back, a connection is seen between air pollution and miscarriages along the Wasatch Front. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Aaron Alberti, and this is our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or posting your comments at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Aaron Alberti, there is new research that shows that women living along the Wasatch Front could have an increased risk for miscarriage as a result of our air pollution. This is from a study by University of Utah researchers. Can you describe what these findings are, Aaron?
Yeah. From the University of Utah, they looked kind of retrospectively at miscarriages, looking at women who had come to the emergency department to report on pregnancy loss, and then tied their zip codes where they live to the air pollution levels in the days leading up to the miscarriage, and identified that a spike in nitrogen dioxide could result in up to a 16% increased risk of miscarriage. And when they're talking about miscarriage, they're talking about pregnancy losses up to 20 weeks. It's not the same thing as a stillbirth. Yeah, that's what they're describing.
Can I ask, is that nitrogen dioxide a component of our air pollution, of our winter time, you know, our inversions?
Yeah, it is. And it's not the same thing as the particulate matter, which is kind of, and the ozone, which is what you usually see kind of represented. It's a different thing, and there's different things you got to do to avoid it. It's harder to avoid than the particulate matter, for example. There isn't as much you can do about it, but yeah, it is associated with an increased risk of miscarriage. Now, it's not, and I mean, I talked to several obstetricians about this information, including some who are very, like, kind of big advocates of air pollution issues, or, well, fixing air pollution issues.
Yeah.
And they all said that, you know, people shouldn't completely freak out, and especially women who have experienced miscarriages shouldn't think, oh, there was something I could do to prevent it. I mean, this isn't the kind of risk that you can say, oh, well, clearly you were here in Utah and that's why you miscarried. Like, it's not like that. So, but it is an increased risk, and that does add to a much larger body of research that is increasingly showing associations between pregnancy problems and birth problems and conception problems to air pollution of different types and at different times of year.
Matthew Fuller, who's the assistant professor of surgery at the University of Utah Health, who's the senior author on this paper, he called these results upsetting, that sort of correlation there that you're describing, and said that society needs to find solutions to these problems. And I want to get to that part in a minute, that aspect of finding solutions. But you, in the sort of second component of your reporting on this, you looked at the disconnect between that research and the experience of prospective or expectant mothers and what they're being told by their doctors. Can you tell us about that sort of gap in, I don't know, communication maybe?
Yeah, I interviewed a number of doctors, and I had contact with a lot, at least two dozen women who are expecting or recently were pregnant, about whether this is, you know, air pollution is even coming up in doctor's appointments and prenatal appointments. And overwhelmingly, people said no. Even obstetricians who are, you know, activists in the clean air world said that they don't 100% of the time talk about this with their patients. There's just a lot to talk about. One of the doctors I talked to, Dr. Hutchison, who is the Utah chair for ACOG, the obstetrician and gynecological, like, a professional group, said that, you know, it can be hard for lay people and patients to maybe understand the force of evidence that's needed to guide a medical recommendation, that they can't say, well, you really should do this. You know, you should wear a mask. You should stay inside all the time. You should be exactly this worried based on, you know, early research, and said that more research is needed to kind of guide those recommendations. Like, you can't on a hunch or a hedge provide medical advice.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I just wanted to say it's essentially don't oversell just the results of this one study.
Oversell the certainty of it.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just going to remind listeners to call in again, 801-355-8255. However, though, you went into the however part there, and I'm wondering if you were going to bring up recommendations that some of these people, some of these experts made about how you might protect yourself, despite there not being conclusive evidence of that correlation.
Right. Well, and I mean, and beyond that, this does kind of, in a lot of the women that I spoke with, create some kind of, I mean, in some cases, anxiety, in some cases, just confusion, because it's, you know, there are things that you can do to reduce your exposure to air pollution. You can stay inside when it's a red air day or orange air day or yellow air day. One thing that I didn't even know about, and I feel kind of stupid for not knowing about it, because I've always seen the little button on my car and not known what it meant, the recirculate button, keeps new air from coming in, which is pretty self-explanatory when you look at the button, but I've never pushed it. Yeah. And they're like, push the button, because that will help. As far as the nitrogen dioxide, the kind of the only thing you can do for that is to get a carbon charcoal air filter in your home. Mm. And that's the best place to control your exposure to that. The masks that people wear, it depends on whether you've got the right one. It doesn't filter out the nitrogen dioxide, but particulate matter has also been associated with some risks. And the masks do help with that if you get the N95 masks and have a tight, tight fit. Like, you can't have any air escaping through the sides of it. So, and then don't drive as much. You get more exposure to air pollution while you're on the road. Don't contribute to it by idling. And don't burn wood. I mean, all the other things you do to avoid that any high risk or highly sensitive population does to avoid air pollution. What is missing is doctors telling pregnant women that they may be a highly sensitive population when it comes to air pollution, because it's not even coming up.
Well, and then there is kind of in your article as well, the fact that you know, poor air quality isn't something that a lot of people have the luxury to escape, or who can necessarily afford the masks or afford the filters that they could get in their homes to cut back on indoor air pollution. And you wrote that the highest polluting or the highest pollution neighborhoods tend to house lower income families as well. And that's, you know, it shows something disproportionate. And there's a sort of, you know, moral or environmental justice aspect to this, Aaron, that doesn't always get talked about. Can you sort of talk about what people you spoke to had to say about that part of the story?
Yeah, and you can look, I mean, almost anywhere in the valley, you can see the McMansions creeping up the slopes where it's higher and you're farther away from the highways and you're farther up from where the inversion tends to settle. You know, lower income neighborhoods tend to be lower elevation and closer to the highways that, you know, are where the mountains funnel in, you know, they create the valley there. So, and that's typical. I mean, it's a worldwide phenomenon that higher poverty or lower income is associated with higher environmental risk.
Mm-hmm. So. It's funny. And there's also, I'm wondering if people you spoke to, we talked a little bit about recommendations for protecting yourself personally, including those masks and filters and so on. But then what about on the broader scale on solving the problem for everybody, you know, for people who can't afford the masks or expensive air filters, you know, from the sort of policy prescription level, did people you were talking to in your article talk about addressing from, say, a policy level at the state level, the air pollution that is causing not just, you know, problems for pregnancies. There's research that shows an increase in heart attacks on days when you have elevated, not even red air days, which means that if you don't know you have heart disease and you go outside, the air pollution could kill you on a given day. And that's from a study in the Journal of American, the American Medical Association by Harvard researchers. And now we add miscarriages to the list. What did the researchers and doctors you spoke with for this article, Aaron, say about what's needed to fix this problem, or did they?
Well, yeah, they talked about it. It really depends on how aggressive people want to be in regulating behavior that causes pollution. I think it was Mexico City. One of the doctors I talked to said in Mexico City, which had, you know, pretty extreme pollution, they started restricting driving. Like, if your license plate ended in a certain number, if it ended in an odd number, you couldn't drive on certain days. And if it ended on an even number, you couldn't drive on certain days. That would be a pretty big change around here. You know, where are refineries to operate? Things like that came up. So it's just how forceful a measure is anybody willing to take for something like this? And it's just hard to tell because the urgency of air pollution and health isn't consistently communicated. I mean, there's a reason when you're looking at something like miscarriages, there's a reason these women who are expecting are feeling a little anxious and confused, because in some cases it's like, well, we're not really going to do anything about it. They'll put up a funny highway sign or something telling you to not drive. But then in other circumstances, it's like, oh, well, it's a red air day. Like, thousands of kids along the Wasatch Front can't even go outside for 10 minutes for recess. So it's like, well, which is it? And then your doctor's not talking to you about whether this is bad for your unborn child. Meanwhile, you are, like, anxiously warned by everybody, you know, don't eat sushi. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been pregnant, Roger,
no.
But it's a special time, the interest that people take in your personal health. Like,
right.
Oh, what, you went hiking without a cell phone? How dare you take that kind of risk with the life of your unborn child?
Well, questions about how, you know, whether or not you can consume alcohol. Blue cheese is something you're supposed to.
You can't change your cat's litter, supposedly.
Okay.
Well, I didn't. But then if you bring up your own health risks, suddenly, oh, why are you such a hypochondriac? Why don't you stay off Google? So it's like, You get that vibe, you know, set in the context of this very inconsistent messaging on the urgency of air pollution. And it makes it hard to even bring up in a doctor's office because you kind of don't want to get made fun of. And, and some of the women I talked to had problems where previously they had raised concerns with their doctors that were kind of dismissed, and it made them embarrassed. And it makes you not want to ask questions. And maybe that sounds like an extreme reaction, but if you don't think that you're going to be taken seriously, or if you're conditioned to think that every concern you have for your own health is hypochondriac, then you don't talk about it.
There's a sort of social censoring self-censoring that happens as a result of that, because you don't want to be seen as the Chicken Little,
the hysterical pregnant woman.
Right. Exactly. Okay. I guess there's still this divide though between like personal health and masks and the public health aspect of this. And people aren't going to voluntarily give up driving and do the, you know, even odd license plates numbers as you described in Mexico City. I think they do that in Beijing as well. Mexico City actually moved refineries away from the city where they used to be, and have that's cut back a lot on their air pollution. You know, do we have the wherewithal? And I know this is kind of this is sort of a question that maybe you can't answer, Aaron, as a reporter. But I'm wondering if we have the wherewithal as a state to engage in that kind of curbing. You know, not just on the individual self-censoring or self-regulating way, but do lawmakers or does the state have the wherewithal to try and deal with that? Or enforce regulations that might make a difference in air pollution?
I don't know. I mean, and it's also the kind of thing where the medical evidence can stack up. I mean, what's the threshold for when it's like, oh, well, this is so severe, we'll act on it. I mean, I don't know. Is it going to be like the frog in boiling water? I mean, it's and the research is still developing. I mean, it takes, as Dr. Hutchison said, it does take a long time for, I mean, any of these studies to be replicated to the point of certainty where you change medical advice. So what is it going to take to change public policy as extreme as, you know, forbidding half of the cars in the valley from driving on a certain day?
Right. Right. And so, I mean, that's circling back to a point that this is kind of a social justice or moral issue as well. One of the people that you spoke to in the article about miscarriages and the data on that, or the correlation, articulated that point in the final quote of your story, where they said that something along the lines of, you know,
are you only pro-life and pro-family when it suits your checkbook, is what she said. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a question, I guess, that our society sort of has to ask and then answer itself. I've got somebody who can comment on this who just walked into the studio, and Robert Gerke, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been talking about air quality, air pollution, and the link to miscarriages. I asked Aaron a question that was maybe unfair to ask a reporter, which was, does the state have the wherewithal to maybe regulate or implement regulations with teeth, say driving regulations or something that will prevent bad air quality from, or, you know, our inversions from being as bad as they are? And think about that question?
Well, I mean, I think there are steps that can be taken that this legislature and the political leaders haven't had the will to do, and that, you know, things like, you know, impose a carbon tax or you know, to discourage people from driving, or try to implement, you know, we've seen some sort of half steps, half measures, you know, the building code changes, the
right.
water heater things, those are good. But yeah, they've kind of held back on doing anything that would be prescriptive, I guess. And so, more and more there's pressure from the public because they don't like the dirty air. And now we see not just sort of asthma and other health consequences, but as Aaron's story pointed out, we see issues with miscarriages now. And so, you know, the evidence is all there. It's got to build up to a point where there's pressure on them to act.
I just wonder if, I mean, this is maybe cynical, but I wonder if the fact that we're talking about pregnancy, we're talking about miscarriages, if that is in some ways for Utah lawmakers in particular, a more, provides a greater imperative for them to act.
Well, yeah. I mean, if they're going to, you know, that quote is sort of hits it on the head. The one you referenced is, you know, if we're going to call ourselves pro-family, if we're going to call ourselves, you know, say that we want the best for our children, if we're going to, you know, be pro-life, then these are all things that we have to take into account.
Okay. Aaron's reporting on this is available at sltrip.com. It's really it's chock full of data and really interesting stories from women who are trying to find out what kind of advice they should get from their doctors and that disconnect between data and the doctor's office. Check it out at sltrip.com. We need to take another break on the show. When we come back, we've got more to come, including attempts by two neighbors of a homeless clinic in Salt Lake City's east side to get a homeless facility shut down there. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Robert Gerke, Aaron Alberti, and Taylor Stevens. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255, or you can go to the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com. I thought we had a caller here on air quality in Salt Lake City, and maybe we'll try and get them back in a little bit. But for the moment, I will turn to a story that was reported by Taylor Stevens. And Taylor, the in-between is a homeless hospice. It's a place where people who are homeless and ill, sometimes terminally ill, go for treatment and care. 6 months ago, in May, the facility moved to a location in a more affluent location, it's on the Salt Lake City's east side, and a small group of residents in that neighborhood weren't very happy about the fact that this had arrived in their neighborhood, and they're still not happy 6 months later. Can you tell us about their issues with the in-between and what they're trying to do?
Yeah, and their issues are many. Their issues have to do with licensing, with zoning, but I would say their primary concern is that this was, they believe, marketed to them as a hospice for people who are terminally ill, but it also serves people who need medical respite. Any condition on the streets can escalate. If it's just a minor leg wound, that might be easy to fix for someone who has the means to do so. But on the streets, it can be, you know, those kind of things can escalate to the point where maybe that minor leg wound needs to be amputated. And so they say that's an important part of their work. But these residents are upset because they say if anyone with any kind of medical difficulty can come and stay at the in-between, then the in-between is operating as a homeless shelter, a de facto homeless shelter, and not as a hospice. So that, I would say, is their kind of major concern. And in the 6 months since the in-between has moved into the neighborhood, we've really seen this escalate. Residents were upset at the beginning. It happened kind of quickly. Real estate transactions, you know, can take place very quickly, and they were surprised. And in the 6 months since, there is a small group of residents who is really leading this movement to get the in-between out of their neighborhood altogether. They have gone to community meetings to voice their dissent. They've raised $5,500 through a GoFundMe account to attain legal counsel. They have been issued a cease and desist letter for what the in-between says is inaccurate statements made about the organization on social media, and they're no longer allowed on the property because of what the in-between says is their behavior there. So it really has escalated over the last few months.
What are those statements on social media that you just described that these residents are making about the in-between that are getting them? I mean, not to amplify that, but I'm just curious what it is that they're saying. Are they, you in your article say that they're citing criminal activity or the potential for criminal activity, maybe?
Yeah, and I think, again, the main thing comes back to this is operating as a homeless shelter. The in-between argues and says that they, by law, are required to receive a referral for anyone who comes to stay at the facility. So at a homeless shelter, you can walk up. If there's a bed available for you, you can stay. At the in-between, you need a medical referral to get in. And so I think that's one of the big issues that's happening here is that particular claim.
Other residents, in this neighborhood, this is not a universal opinion of the in-between. In fact, there's a lot of residents in the neighborhood who say that they haven't seen any problems, correct?
Right. And I heard from many residents who said, we love that the in-between is in our neighborhood. We have not had any problems. And I think that is really interesting and kind of goes to the heart of the story, which is, you know, the headline says A Tale of Two Neighborhoods. And that's really what I saw here as I talked to residents, because some would say, you know, my neighborhood has fundamentally changed. I see drug deals in my neighborhood. People are sleeping in their cars. And other people say, you know, there's a lot less traffic than when this was a rehab facility. I've never seen a single issue. I feel completely safe walking through my neighborhood. And so it's interesting to hear these vastly different perspectives on their neighborhood. But you know, these neighbors who are for the in-between, they say that there are more of them, but they're not as organized, perhaps. So they have started a YIMBY group, Yes in My Backyard. They are trying to raise money for the in-between and trying to get their perspective out there that, you know, not everybody is against this neighborhood against this facility. And in the kind of aftermath of the story, I think there's been a lot of rhetoric of, you know, the East Side, these people are evil, this, you know, and I think that they want to say, no, listen, this isn't everyone. We're here and we are compassionate and we care about serving this population.
There, what did the management at the in-between say, the caregivers there essentially, what did they say about what's happening around their facility? How do they respond to this?
I think that they are, you know, they have a lot to contend with on the inside. They are trying to offer care to people who are in many times at the end of their life. They want to dialogue with neighbors is what they say, but some of the tactics, I think, have grown too aggressive for them, which is why we've seen the cease and desist letter, which is why we've seen them issue no trespass orders to some of the neighbors. I think that this is a really interesting story because although it is a single neighborhood, it really is a bigger conversation that happened before the three resource centers, the locations for those were chosen, and I think will continue as they are put in place and come online in the next year. And so I think that this story illuminates a bigger conversation and not in my backyard sentiment. I think these women are cognizant of that narrative and they take it a step further and they say not in anyone's backyard.
What does that, I saw that quote in your article and I wondered what it meant because, you know, where is that? Where is not in anybody's backyard?
Yeah, and they, you know, argue that this is a high-risk population that, you know, they think brings crime into neighborhoods and they would like to see it in an industrial area, which Erin Mendenhall, Salt Lake City Councilwoman, has noted would be illegal federally, that you can't just zone people in industrial areas. Kim Correa, the executive director, had, you know, she said, these aren't washing machines we're housing. These are people. People need to live with people. And so we're not going to go away. We're not going to go into an industrial zone, but...
Robert Gerke, I don't know if I have a question here, but would just ask for your thoughts on what Taylor has reported.
Well,
on this story.
I was going to say that Taylor did an excellent job reporting it. She was very even-handed with it and represented both sides. I don't have to be even-handed, and I'm not going to be because I think these women are horrible people. You have these people who are the least fortunate people in our society facing serious medical conditions, and your property values are being hurt, and that's all you can think about. And it's this typical East Side mentality that we saw with this location of the homeless shelters. They're fine if we put them in South Salt Lake. It's fine if we put them in West Valley, but don't put anything on the East Side that's going to hurt our property values. And I you know, applaud the people who are welcoming the in-between into their neighborhood and say it's an asset or say that it's you know, recognize that it needs to be somewhere. But these people who are trying to drive it out because based on really nothing except the perception that they might, you know, that their property values might suffer, I think it's, you know, especially around this time of the year, around the holidays, it's one of the most unchristian things you can possibly do.
Taylor,
got a little worked up.
Well, Robert Gerke's, he can take the wheels off and say whatever he wants. But Taylor, these women have pledged to keep up their Their fight against the in-between in this neighborhood, they want to see it closed down or at least not expanded. In-between is talking about expanding the number of beds they will have to help people who are homeless and ill.
Yeah, and what the in-between has said, so right now they're currently zoned for 50 beds, and the regulations are such that they can have 25 on the hospice side and 25 on the medical care side. So say they have, you know, 26 people who need help with the hospice side, they can't let that 26th person in, even though they have the beds for it. So it's kind of just a complex zoning issue. They want to increase to 75 beds, but they say that they wouldn't ever expect to have more than 50. That just gives them a little bit of freedom to offer care to people who, you know, maybe give them a little bit more flexibility for that.
And the neighbors, those neighbors who are in opposition to this, they are raising funds. They're trying to get a legal advice. Is that they're trying to hire lawyers to do what? Do we know?
They have obtained legal counsel. I think that they're, you know, ideally they don't want to have to go that route, they say. But I think the in-between has dug its heels in. It says it's not leaving this neighborhood. They have dug their heels in. They say they're not going to stop this effort. And so I think we may see it come to head in a legal battle.
Wouldn't it be great, though, if instead of a legal battle, they raise money to help the neediest people in our community? I mean, that would be another way to approach this, I think.
Yeah, the in-between said that it's raised a ton of money since the article ran.
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting article, and you can check it out at the Tribune's website, sltrib.com. And Taylor Stevens, thanks for your report on this. I want to actually circle back to a conversation we were having earlier about air quality and miscarriages and just dealing with air pollution along the Wasatch Front, because we have a caller on the line who wants to address that. And this is David in Salt Lake City. David, are you there?
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course. What's your comment? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I've got a couple of thoughts on it. I've got a couple of thoughts on the in-between, too. I think it's a great thing, and I'm proud to have it in Salt Lake. But that's, of course, literally another story. I think it's interesting that we're talking so much about inversion, and rightfully so, just as increased fees that the legislature passed last year, disincentivizing clean air vehicles, of course. I drive a hybrid. I drive a 2000 hybrid Insight, which literally is worth about $900, but it's still the leader of MPG. Nothing's ever come close to it. But now they're going to start charging extra fees for that and all clean air vehicles next year. And it's just such a mistake, especially with hybrids, which is literally taxing efficiency, since every mile that the car drives is gasoline powered. So it does have the fees for road maintenance and such. I can see a little bit of an argument for electric vehicles and such, which don't pay into those road fees. But of course, really, it's, you know, stepping over dollars for dimes when we're also talking about spending millions on clean air efforts to raise maybe at the most $1,000 in increased fees. And kind of separately, I think it's important when we're talking about the inversion to realize that so much of the pollution is not just coming from our tailpipes or even industrial uses, but of course animal agriculture. Think of Cache County as a great example, where the inversion is often much worse than anywhere else in the state, but of course they don't have that vehicle. But what do they have up there? I got lots of cows.
Sure.
And it's something to think about.
David, thank you.
You know, when we're thinking about clean air, we've got a chance three times a day to sit down to a meal to vote for clean air.
David, thank you for your comments. We're going to chew on them here for just a second while we have time in the show.
Well, I appreciate it.
Appreciate
thank
the
you
call.
So much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Robert Gerke, I'll turn to you on this. I mean, there's a fee on electric and hybrid vehicles that the legislature did. Implement that's coming online soon.
Soon this year, yeah. If you drive a hybrid or an electric vehicle, you're going to be paying more to get it registered. I believe it's $10 or $15 for an electric, and you know, I think $8 for a hybrid. And his point is valid. I think that, you know, we need to look at our policies and what we're incentivizing and disincentivizing, and are we trying to encourage people to drive more efficient cars, or are we paying for the roads? And we have to do both, but where are we going to find the balance? You know, it's sort of it's sort of a similar mentality to trying to get rid of the rooftop solar incentive, you know? Or are we trying to encourage people to adopt these, you know, more efficient, cleaner, you know, measures? Or are we, you know, trying to incentivize burning coal, for example, you know? Is that what we should be fighting for? So I think David's point is very well taken, that if we're going to... The legislature and the policymakers and the governor can't say they're doing everything that can be done to help the inversion if our policies don't align and don't encourage and encourage the opposite of that goal.
Well, you often hear an argument being made, and I don't know if this is a question for you or Aaron Alberti, but an argument being made from policymakers, not necessarily here in Utah, but elsewhere, that impinging or greater regulation is going to lead to decreased economic activity.
Well, I mean, I think right now our economy in the state is churning along fine, you know. I don't think that, in fact, we've seen sort of the opposite argument made, I think, from people in economic development who say one of the biggest drawbacks, one of the biggest deterrents to companies wanting to locate here is the bad air. I mean, it's hard for them to convince their employees that they want to relocate to Salt Lake City when they know that their kids are going to have to stay in from recess and they might have asthma. You know, it's not worth it to them.
Or there might be miscarriages as a result. I mean, there's a lot to weigh into that. I'm sorry, David, we didn't get to address all of your question there, but we are running low on our time here and probably should move on to other stories. I wanted to just quickly dip into one that Taylor Stevens covered, which was something that happened last night, which was a vigil. This relates back to stories we've been talking about related to homelessness, a vigil that you covered on homeless deaths in Salt Lake, people who had died in Salt Lake City or in Utah over the past year. Can you tell us about this vigil?
Yeah, 121 deaths, some of those on the streets, some of those in care facilities like the in-between or in rapid rehousing. And for some of these people, this is the only recognition that their deaths will ever really receive. And so it's just a time where homeless service providers, members of the community, and people experiencing homelessness themselves can come together and, you know, recognize these deaths and say, this matters to us as a community and we've got to do better.
Who was in attendance at this vigil? I mean, it was homeless service providers and some state leaders as well.
Yeah, we had Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, and Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams. So there were some public officials who were there. I believe that Governor Herbert had signed a proclamation declaring the day as Homeless Persons Recognition Day. A lot of presence there.
You know, I would have us go further into this, and Robert Gerke wrote a great column on the amount of money being spent on helping the homeless that we don't know what it's doing. We talked a little bit about that on this show last week. However, it is time right now to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Robert, do you want to start us off?
I guess I would choose this story that it happened, and I believe yesterday and the day before, there were two women at the Duchesne County Jail who died while in custody. And it's sort of, there's been a larger look statewide at policies at the jails and what can be done to try to, you know, keep this from happening. I believe one of them was a suicide. The other one was, she was coming off of drugs and didn't get the care that, supposedly didn't get the care she needed. I guess there's still going to be an investigation into that. But, you know, this has been a problem that we've seen around the state. We had more than 70 deaths, I believe, in the last, four or five years. And there's an effort by the legislature to try to look at this. But, the policies from jail to jail are inconsistent. And I think that's going to demand a little bit more careful and a little more scrutiny.
Okay. That's Robert Kirky's pick for Underplayed Story. Check it out at sltrip.com. Aaron Alberti, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Well, I don't know if I'd characterize this as underplayed, but the University of Utah released investigations into the death of Lauren McCluskey, who was murdered by Melvin Rowland earlier this year, of course. And today, Courtney Tanner has a story about her parents' reaction to all of this. They are not very pleased with how the university has responded to the findings. The university said that there was nothing they could have done to prevent her death. Her parents say, look, she made several complaints. Her first complaint, it took a week for a case to even be opened. They didn't check his parole status, which could have led to charges based on some of her allegations. And so they say that people should be disciplined, which so far is not happening.
And I think the president's statement that nothing could be done, but we did everything right, but we're going to change how we do it, is kind of just a little
internal logic issues there.
So anyway, read the story. It's well done.
Check it out. And we will go to Taylor Stevens for her pick of underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I want to highlight a story from my colleague Sean Means about the LGBT couples in Utah who raced to marry 5 years ago after the U.S. District Court ruled Utah's laws against same-sex marriage were unconstitutional. Some great stories from some of those couples in there.
Really, really interesting moment in time. I remember covering that for KCPW way back when, and a bunch of anniversaries are now being celebrated. Check that out at sltrib.com. I'm going to forego my underplayed story of the week just in the interest of time and say many thanks to Robert Gerke, Aaron Alberti, and Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for being here today on Behind the Headlines.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you. Merry Christmas, everybody.
This show is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thank you to everyone who helps make the program possible, including Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan. And thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts at our website, kcpw.org, or through your podcast app. Have a very Merry Christmas. I'm Roger McDonough. We will see you next week.